Good evening and welcome to this Retina UK webinar. My name's Kate Arkell. I'm the Research Development Manager at Retina UK. And this evening, I'm absolutely delighted that we've been joined by scientists representing almost all of our newest projects. They are here to tell us all about how they will be using Retina UK's funds to make a difference to the understanding and future treatment of inherited retinal conditions. I'm going to be asking each of them to introduce themselves more fully during the course of the webinar, but just briefly for now, we have Professor James Sowden from UCL Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health.
Hi.
Professor Jacqueline van der Spy from UCL Institute of Ophthalmology.
Hello.
Hi, and both of them are leading project grants. And then we have Dr. Matteo Rizzi from UCL Institute of Ophthalmology, who's supervising a PhD project that will start very soon.
Yes, hi everyone.
Hi, and a special welcome to our two PhD students, Chloe Bretherton from Edinburgh University and Gabrielle Velichkova from UCL, who are just embarking on their journeys towards becoming the research leaders of the future. Our other new grantee, Dr. Jan Lukowski, unfortunately couldn't make it this evening, but there is information about his project on our website. If you want to know more about that one, you can give us a call or take a look. And that's a project about preserving central vision in retinitis pigmentosa. Just so you're aware, my colleague Lauren Osborne-Lewis, who's our Digital and Events Senior Coordinator, is online. She's here in the background just to help me manage your questions at the end. If you have any questions for the researchers, please do just type them into the Q&A box. You can type them in there at any point during the webinar, but we'll have a question session just for a few minutes or so at the end of the webinar, and I will put your questions to our panelists. So please do ask away. It's lovely to have lots of questions. So we'll get going. So I think we'll start with the students. So Chloe, you're first on my screen. So you're in the hot seat. Do you want to just introduce yourself a little bit more fully? Perhaps tell us how you came to be doing this PhD.
So yeah, I'm Chloe and I studied genetics in Glasgow for my undergraduate degree and then in medical genetics in also in Glasgow for my master's degree.
Okay.
And during that time I realised that like in rare diseases is something that I was really passionate about, and I'm sure you all know that 1 in 20 people suffer from rare diseases and it's so common and something that I really wanted to help with and help people. And so my partner's dad is partially sighted, is retinal schistosis, and seeing the impact it has on his life really made me quite passionate about helping people who are partially sighted or blind. And it kind of quite lucky came up, this PhD came up whilst I was looking at the role of RP jarring.
Perfect. So when did you start? When did you actually start on the project? Was it last autumn?
Yeah, in September.
Okay, so you're a few months in. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us in sort of simple terms, what's the main aim of your project?
Yeah, so there's this one gene that can cause a spectrum of inherited retinal disorders. So it can cause retinitis pigmentosa, which is where like your rods start to go first, or it can cause like a macular dystrophy where your cones start to go first, or anywhere in between, and we don't really know why.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so what I'm trying to figure out is why different mutations in this gene cause the spectrum of disorders.
Yeah, so just to clarify, if the rods go first, they're more responsible for our peripheral vision, right? And cones are in the center in the macula, mm-hmm. and they're more responsible for our central vision. So we know that this gene can cause one or the other to deteriorate first. So what's your sort of plan for your project? How are you going to go about understanding a little bit more why sometimes we get central vision loss ahead of peripheral vision loss?
Well, one part of it that I'm actually doing now, coming in the Netherlands now, learning this new technique.
Okay, well, yeah.
That they do over here and we don't do back in the UK. So it's really interesting. So I'm using mice retinas and making them basically flow, well, making them four times bigger. so that I can see what is happening in the retina at a higher like resolution, if you get me, so that I can then see what like how the proteins are interacting, what's changing in the rods and the cones, and then hopefully that'll help understand by what no what's changing when we don't have RPGR. We'll know why is this causing them to like die off. I'm also going to be looking at its co like the changes in the protein levels, like when the RPGR is absent from mice again, because hopefully we'll be able to understand if RPGR is causing these different protein levels to change, how that will then impact the structure of the photoreceptors.
Okay, so what do we think is underlying this difference? Is it different mutations, so different spelling mistakes at different places in the gene? Yeah.
So if you think like the gene has like different, we call them domains, so like different sections that make different shapes of the protein. So if the mutations are in certain shapes of the protein, it tends to cause more like a resistance pigmentosa phenotype where the rods go first. If it's in different domain, in a different domain, it could cause the cones, and we think it's to do with like the proteins that they talk to and interact with, because it different domains talk to different proteins.
So quite nitty-gritty, like at that molecular level, really, isn't
Yeah.
it? And what are you hoping when you, if you can get to the bottom of this a little bit more and increase our understanding of this, what are you hoping that will do to help some of those who might be listening this evening?
So currently there is a gene therapy trial for retinitis pigmentosa with RPGR. However, there's no gene therapy trial for those who are suffering from more of a macular dystrophy caused by mutations in RPGR, and hopefully by elucidating the mechanism changes it, we might be able to then help and develop a gene therapy for those individuals.
Okay, so do you think that gene therapy could be different then to the one that's being used for RP at the moment that's being tested?
Possibly, I'm not sure. I think hopefully we'll be able to figure out if the one that's being used for RP would be able to be used for those with, but we need to figure out why it's different first.
Yeah, absolutely. And that understanding is really what underlies therapy development in the first place, isn't it? So you're in the Netherlands at the moment, is that right?
Yes, I am,
And how is
yes.
that going to a completely a different country, a different institution? How's that been?
It's been really nice. Obviously, everyone does everything differently, different techniques, different way of working. And one of the best things about science is the collaboration behind it and being able to collaborate and see how they use, because they see Leber congenital amaurosis over here. So being able to see how they use the same techniques to look at different things will help me when I go back to Edinburgh and be able to use their techniques on RP, well, retinitis
Your
pigmentosa
project.
or cone dystrophies. Yeah.
How difficult is this technique to learn? Has it been challenging or not too bad?
It's been not too bad actually. They're really great over here. They've been really supportive. So that's been really good. Just fingers crossed now I can actually take it back to Edinburgh successfully.
I'm sure you'll be fine. And Chloe, what are you hoping to do with your future career? Because we know that a PhD is essential. It's the first step, isn't it, for a research career. What are you kind of hoping to do? Do you want to stick with rare disease? Do you want to stay in academia?
I would like to stick with rare disease. I think long term, I think I'd like to get into university lecturing and to help like the next generation of scientists, because it really was the lecturers that inspired me to get to where I am now. But definitely sticking in academia and help and like find out more information and be able to help more people.
Excellent. And Chloe's hopefully you're going to come along, aren't you, to our annual conference in September as well. So that'll be really lovely. Talk about the project in a little bit more depth. And you'll have a little bit more under your belt by then as well. So that will be good. Great. Gabrielle. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you ended up doing this project?
Yeah, of course. So I did my bachelor's with an integrated master's in genetics at the University of Manchester. And there I discovered my passion for developmental biology, which is why I did a project looking at two developmental signaling pathways. And that really drove me later on to take upon project as a different project as a research technician in that field, and it allowed me to gain over 3 years of experience. And I learned how to use stem cells, human embryonic mouse, human induced pluripotent stem cells, which are quite exciting now, also to get involved with different techniques like molecular cloning or this molecular scissors called CRISPR that I'm sure everybody has heard about. And this made me really, really passionate about genetic engineering. So when I saw the project that is really taking and learning how you can use this CRISPR technology to do all kinds of clever experiments, it really drove me in that direction. And I also really wanted to learn how to do disease models in vitro in the forms of organoids, which in my case are retinas, like retinas in a dish. That was very exciting for me. And also the opportunity to develop something as a gene therapy that can later on be possibly translated into the patients in the clinic. You can really see how the basic research could make an impact in patients' lives. So that's the reason.
Excellent. And before you tell us exactly what your project is, do you want to just explain very briefly and simply, if you can, what CRISPR is? Because there might be some people who haven't heard of that.
Okay, so what CRISPR is basically that very nice little system that allows you to go into the DNA of a person. So the DNA is composed of these little blocks that give you information how to create specific proteins. And what the system does is basically we have a little guide that leads us to a specific location in the DNA. And this guide brings a little protein together with it that allows it to clip the DNA in precise locations. Now, why would we want to do that? Usually, when we have these genes, we have changes which make the gene dysfunctional because we no longer have the information that we need. But having these molecular scissors, now we can go within the DNA, clip out the wrong part. And then we could also provide a little template that tells you, okay, now this is the correct piece of the puzzle. Let's put it back. And that's the idea behind CRISPR in simplified
Perfect.
versions.
That was a beautiful explanation. Thank you so much for that. That was absolutely brilliant. And so, more specifically now, can you tell us about your project and what you're going to do?
Yeah, my project is quite exciting, actually. So it's focusing on Stargardt disease. Which is actually the most common eye disorder in the world, Mendelian eye disorder in the world, because it affects every 1 in 10,000 people. And what's the reason, what's causing Stargardt disease is this protein that is called ABCA4. It's very heterogeneous, which means that one patient that has Stargardt disease could have one change in their gene, and another patient can have another. And to date, there are over 2,200 different variants that we have observed. So it makes it very complicated. But why is ABCA4 important? Now, the way that we perceive the world is, let's say, we see an object and the light hits the object, and that light gets reflected back into our eyes. In our eyes, we have cells which are capable of recognizing this signal. They're the light sensing cells. And they convert the light into an electrical signal and then into a chemical signal that our brain interprets, and it produces this picture. Now, this is called the visual cycle or phototransduction. And during this cycle, we produce toxic compounds, which, if they accumulate, they start to affect the underlying layer of the retina, which is composed of these retinal pigmented cells. These retinal pigmented cells are really important, actually, for supporting the photoreceptors or the light sensing cells. So, if we see dysfunction of the RPE cells, we also start to lose the light sensing cells. Now, this is manifested in patients in first steps are people are starting to lose their ability to adapt to dark environments. They lose their color, and later on, as the disease progresses, people start to lose their central vision. The really worrying thing about this is that currently there is no therapy.
Yeah.
So people have to really battle with this disease. Now, there has been a lot of effort into the development of different therapies. There has been a stem cell replacement therapy. There have been drugs, but so far nothing has really proven to be a very efficient or a long-term solution. And because of that, people have started to go in the direction of gene therapy.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with ABCA4 is that ABCA4 is absolutely massive. It's 50 exons. And usually the way people do gene therapy is by using these adeno-associated viruses because they're very common, they don't cause side effects, you don't really cause any other changes in the personal in the DNA of the patient. But the antivirus, adeno-associated viruses are too small for
yeah.
our ABCA4 gene.
So it just doesn't fit.
It does not fit. So people have tried to split it into pieces and to put it back together, but you can imagine that that doesn't always prove to be scarless. You could have improper assembly of this protein and it could go to different places. So it's not the ideal case scenario. But thankfully, we have genetic engineering advancing like the speed of light, and we have new technologies. And the reason why my project is exciting is because we have this prime editing. It sounds very fancy. But essentially what it allows you to do is instead of getting a gene that's the correct gene or the
yeah.
correct string of units to incorporate into these photosensitive cells, you can actually create this system that goes into the cells and corrects their own DNA, which is the idea of my project. It sounds really good because if possible, it could open the opportunity for making new gene therapies. But the idea of my project is to see, can we create this system and does it work in our disease model?
And can you tell, this is genuinely for my benefit as well, prime editing. What's special yeah. about prime editing?
Okay.
Is that very difficult?
I will try to explain this as simple as possible. So usually when you're using CRISPR technology, when you go with these CRISPR scissors, what you do is you make, the DNA has usually two strands. Now, with the CRISPR, you break both of the strands,
yeah,
which is problematic because when you try to fix it, the mechanisms which work for the correction of these mistakes can incorporate mistakes themselves, or you could lose this piece of DNA.
Okay. Yeah.
So there are a lot of things that can happen wrong. But with prime editing, the really nice thing is that you have this guide that brings you to the specific DNA location. It makes a little cut on one of the strands of the DNA.
Okay.
And it provides you actually with the template or the information that you need to correct this change. So you have the whole machinery, and that actually limits the number of mistakes that you can make when you're making this change. And that also decreases the amount of other targets in the genome where this guide can lead you to.
Okay, so this is sounding like it's going to be safer. Is that right, potentially?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, and fewer off-target edits.
Precisely.
Okay,
yeah.
Lovely. And just quickly, before I move on, Gabrielle, what are you hoping to do with your career? Do you know yet? I know it's early days in your PhD.
Yeah, so I hope that the project will go great and we'll get to really prove that prime editing is a useful strategy. So I think that's my first hope for the future. But afterwards, I really want to become very proficient with this molecular cloning and CRISPR technologies and the retinal organoids. And later, maybe use this as a stepping stone into a postdoctoral position or even maybe working in the next steps. Now, if this works, how do we translate this into a therapy, maybe working in a pharmaceutical company with an interdisciplinary team that actually brings the basic research into translation into clinic? So I think that will be very exciting.
That's great. Thank you so much. That's lovely. Our final PhD studentship, we've got Matteo to tell us about. Matteo, do you want to explain a little bit about the project?
Yeah.
The student hasn't actually started yet, has she? Because various reasons. So you've very kindly come along to tell us about the project. And this has got a lovely story behind it as well, really, in terms of how it was the student's idea, right?
Exactly. So this is a studentship that Hasina Abbar will start with us in a few weeks, actually in May. And so it is a very special story because, by the way, Hasina is on maternity leave. That's why she's unable to talk tonight. But so it's a very nice story because Hasina is both a scientist and she was in our lab, but also she has been diagnosed herself with Stargardt disease. And so she has brought to the lab this dual point of view, where at the same time she can understand very well the mechanism and the gene therapy that we're designing in the lab, etc., but also has a very personal experience with it, of course. And actually, the project is very much about that because it's about the symptoms, the kind of the feelings that the perception that patients with Stargardt disease have. And it really started, first of all, with Hasina's own experience. We're talking about particularly two aspects, two symptoms of the condition, which we found actually were very underrated by the doctors that see these patients. So one of them is sometimes we call it photophobia, although that kind of makes it sound like, a fear, like arachnophobia or something else. And it's a bit of a misnomer. I think light aversion maybe is a better word. So essentially, for patients, it was known for other conditions that if you have some condition that affects your eyes, you are very sensitive to light. And you find it easily annoying. You tend to wear sunglasses, etc. But this was surprisingly underappreciated in Stargardt disease. And so Hasina brought this to our attention. The other one is photopsia, which essentially means light flashes. And the way, I mean, this is quite interesting because if you've never experienced it, you don't quite know. So the way I'm describing it is the way it's been reported to me by Hasina and other patients. Of course, I don't know it myself. But the idea is that you see light flashes, even if there is no actual flash happening in front of you. So it's essentially an illusion. And these, first of all, my conversation with Hasina, I understood that this is actually can be quite scary because it comes out of nowhere. So the light aversion is something that is perhaps more understandable. You go out, it's sunny, you have to wear glasses. But light flashes come out of the blue, and so that can be quite unsettling. But again, also, it was very underrated and underreported. So, for example, and so what happened then is that Hasina, in the first instance, decided to see how many other patients reported this, because it could have been I had only met Hasina at that point as a Stargardt patient. So, and actually, it turns out that the vast majority of patients have the same experience. So about 90% of them, for example, have these light flashes. It was interesting because also in the questionnaire that Hasina made, she left like a box for comments at the end, and quite a few patients shared how frustrated they had been with the fact that, it had not been recognized, or some of them were told that it was another reason, it was not their condition that caused them. So, like that. And now this has grown. So it's been very nice because from one person, it's gone to a few. And now the PhD will focus on expanding this even further to a bigger cohort of patients. And the idea is not only to have a bigger group to validate these findings, but also then to be able to see whether this is explained by particular features of the condition. For example, does it depend how young you are when it starts, or does it depend which part exactly of your eye, or how big is the part of the eye that is affected? So all these are aspects that Hasina will try and look at.
And how ultimately, by developing this understanding, this is obviously going to be really helpful for those living with Stargardt's if clinicians have a better understanding and a clearer idea of these symptoms. And that will obviously reduce frustration. But ultimately, is there also a way that the understanding how these symptoms fit with what's going on in the eye, that might give us other learnings that could help in other ways?
Definitely, yeah. So actually, my lab primarily focuses on gene therapy. So this is very much something that Hasina has started, but most of the projects focus on gene therapy. And one of our projects is a form of gene therapy to try and reduce this extreme light aversion that patients report. So that could be for, you know, that if it's confirmed that these patients also suffer from that, we would maybe one day have a way to help alleviate these symptoms. The other symptom as well, so the light flashes,
mm-hmm.
probably are, I mean, clearly they are generated somewhere in the eye, right? And so if we understand that, it might be that they're a symptom of how the disease is progressing or the time course of the condition.
Okay.
And so this will also allow us to understand the different stages of the condition better.
Okay. And you know, it can't be, I've come across people in our community who are really, really disabled by these flashes of light. So, I mean, it can't be underestimated how much impact these sorts of symptoms can have. So it's great that Hasina, you know, is taking this on and is going to really look at this and get some data that's a little bit more clear. So that's absolutely great. Thank you, Matteo. And when, so Hasina's starting next month.
Yeah.
And again, Hasina and Gabrielle, as well as Chloe, hopefully joining us in Manchester in September, all being well, and we can hear in a bit more depth from all three of them, which will be really, really good. So that was our three PhD projects. Just a reminder, you can type in questions at any time. So if you've got any questions for Chloe, Gabrielle or Matteo, do type them in before you forget them. We'll move on to our project grantees. So the PhD studentships are three-year projects which allow a student to begin their career and get a qualification. Project grants are slightly different. They're led by more experienced researchers, and those doing the day-to-day work have probably already got a PhD and are perhaps a little bit further ahead in their careers. But these projects really give us some really important outcomes. And so, Jackie, do you want to start with you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and perhaps some of the work you've done in the past and how you arrived at this new project?
Yes, of course. Thank you. So I've been at the Institute of Ophthalmology for quite some time. I started there as a Wellcome Trust travelling fellow and sort of progressed from there. I have a very deep interest in fundamental disease mechanisms of inherited retinal diseases. So I'm really interested in what goes wrong with the molecular and cellular level in these various different diseases. And I have a particular focus on early onset congenital inherited retinal diseases, including, you know, macular dystrophies as well, juvenile macular dystrophies. And many of these diseases also fall into the category of being rare or ultra rare. And it has been very challenging, of course, working in a field where these diseases are rare or ultra rare, especially when you start to think about therapeutics. So much of my work, in addition to understanding fundamental mechanisms of disease, is really about developing targeted therapeutic strategies and interventions for these diseases based on these fundamental understandings of disease mechanisms. And there's been two major advancements in the field which have really accelerated, you know, both the understanding of fundamental mechanisms of disease as well as the development of therapeutics, and that's stem cell biology, stem cell technology, and gene editing. So, you know, stem cell technology, for example, has enabled us to take samples or from patients. In my case, with pediatric patients, it's renal epithelial cells. So these are cells that are naturally sloughed off into the urine, and then those can be reprogrammed into induced pluripotent stem cells. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the stem cells. And stem cells, of course, have the capacity to form any tissue in the human body. And in my group, we use those to form retinal organoids, or emulate a neurosensory retina in a dish, if you like, as well as models of the underlying retinal pigment epithelial cells. So those are very, very powerful because they enable us to effectively grow a retina in a dish or an RPE for the first time. And so you can really interrogate mechanisms properly in those models. And also they're very powerful platforms for developing therapies as well. So in my group, we sort of target a wide range of different therapies from pharmaceutical pharmaceutical interventions, so small molecule interventions, all the way to RNA-directed therapies like antisense oligonucleotides. And then, of course, I mentioned gene therapy or gene editing as well. And there's a number of different ways in which we use gene editing. So we use gene editing, first of all, for disease modeling purposes. So Gabrielle very nicely described all of that. So we use gene editing in induced pluripotent stem cells to repair patient mutations to create what we call an isogenic control. And, you know, there's a lot of variability in these systems. So the more you can control for all genetic, you know, variation in genetic background, etc., the better.
Yeah.
So we use gene editing technologies also, for example, if a certain mutation is very rare, then we can introduce the desired changes into control lines as well to make an isogenic line, if you like. And then we differentiate these into our models and we use them as platforms to test. We also use sort of prime editing technologies, very nicely described by Gabrielle, base editing technologies as well, as sort of newer technologies to try to directly repair variations in situ. So a whole spectrum of sort of therapeutic interventions, from the small molecule pharmacological to the RNA directed to the DNA directed sort of therapies.
So can you tell us specifically about this project then, the one that you've now got the funding from Retina UK to carry?
Yeah, thank you, I'd love to. So this particular project is a very interesting one. So it's something that we've been working on for a very long time, and it involves a disease called Leber's congenital amaurosis, which has also been mentioned over here. So very early onset, very severe disease. So Leber's congenital amaurosis is caused by several different genes. In fact, I think it's about 26 now, but the one that we work on is at the very severe end of the spectrum of disease. So this particular form of Leber's congenital amaurosis is caused by a gene called AIPR1. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, when looking at pediatric patients, we know that the therapeutic intervention is within 5 years of birth. So yeah, when these children are born, their vision is very severely impaired. And we know that around about 5 years of age or so, there might be some residual surviving cells or function. So we know there's a very tight window of therapeutic opportunity, yeah, which makes treatments for the disease extremely challenging,
yeah,
very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned before, what we have done is we have taken renal epithelial cells from pediatric patients, infants, in fact. It's very difficult to collect urine from a baby.
I was going to say.
reprogram that into induced pluripotent stem cells. But we have made these retina in a dish models from these patients, as well as using gene editing to make these controls as well, the controls, okay, in which the variation is repaired. So we have a powerful control for these models.
Yeah.
And essentially, what we want to do is we want to understand the very, very early changes that occur in these patients in response to the genetic changes. So this model is quite a powerful model because the gene affected plays a very, very critical role in phototransduction. So again, Gabrielle really nicely described phototransduction, where you have light which comes into the eye. And of course, the light needs to be converted into an electrical signal, which is then transmitted to the brain. And within the phototransduction cascade, there is a protein, if you like, which is called phosphodiesterase. And the role of that is to regulate the levels of another signaling molecule called cyclic GMP. And cyclic GMP, it's a bit of a pathway. The phototransduction cascades consists of a series of steps which are involved in converting this light to an electrical impulse, but the final signaling molecule is something called cyclic GMP. And this cyclic GMP gates these channels or tunnels, if you like, through the membrane of the cell, which results can lead to hyperpolarization of the plasma membrane. So they have, you know, opening and closing of these channels, which is regulated by the cyclic GMP molecule. And when you have these genetic changes in the AIPL1, basically this phosphodiesterase, which I described, is gone, which means, okay, that it cannot regulate these cyclic GMP levels, and you get a, okay, toxic or constitutive accumulation of cyclic GMP in these cells. And this is the very first event which predates cell death pathways.
Okay.
And what's interesting is that in most or many inherited retinal diseases, you get this toxic accumulation of cyclic GMP. So there's a large body of work which is focusing on developing ways in which we can manipulate those levels of cyclic GMP and thereby manipulate the downstream cell death pathways, if you like. So it would be a very early interventional kind of therapy, if you like, where we could maybe look at shifting the equilibrium back the other way before those cells begin to die, which you can imagine is important in a very early onset disease, yes, like Leber's congenital amaurosis.
Yes.
So we have, I'm working together with another researcher in Germany who works with a company called Marika Medicines, and they have developed a whole bunch of small molecules which can target the cyclic GMP, the cell death pathway. And we want to test this molecule in our model. So our model, as I said, it's an excellent model because it really results in, you know, the loss of this pathway in its entirety. So you get this accumulation of this toxic molecule. And so we want to see if we can use these drugs to, as I say, target those the very early initiating events of the cell death pathways, and thereby perhaps in patients, ultimately the idea would be to delay maybe or slow down the loss of vision in those patients, because they are very young. So you can imagine interventional therapies are quite tricky on young patients.
Yeah, and that was a really great comprehensive explanation, and you can really see where the therapeutic intervention might happen in that pathway. Perhaps is that? Do you think that's something that's going to be a drug that people can take orally eventually, or can be given to a baby orally, or?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So what's really great about these drugs is that they are, they've obviously been engineered or bioengineered in such a way that they, A, are very water soluble, B, they're very stable. So the cyclic GMP is basically broken down by phosphodiesterases, but these are resistant to that breakdown. So you can switch on and off. You know, it's programmable, you can switch on and off the in terms of the drug. So the idea is that it would be topical application, which of course for pediatric infants would be really very powerful. However, with the formulations of these drugs as well, in collaboration with this company, they are obviously developing all sorts of nanoparticulate kind of things to deliver them as well, because when you deliver these to the eye, obviously, you know, they need to be able to traverse all the layers. So topical delivery is quite tricky. You know, in terms of there's lots of barriers to things getting into the eye.
So topical, we mean drops, right?
Topical, which would be drops,
which would be easy from a practical point of view with a
More tricky from a formulation point of view. So the other option they're considering is intravitreal as well, but then again, it's much easier than a subretinal, so that it's just an injection into the orbit again. But you know, young patients, I'm sure, you know, if you're a parent and you have a baby and you're offered a drop that might prolong the loss, you know, delay the loss of vision, it's much more preferable to an injection perhaps. But yeah, there are formulations with these drugs for intravitreal delivery as well, but there's similar issues in terms of these things traversing the different layers of the eye to get to the cells where they need to be. However, the ultimate goal is for these drugs to be applied to a wide variety of different inherited retinal diseases, which are characterized by this toxic cyclic GMP accumulation.
I was about to say, it does sound as if this cyclic GMP is so important in other. So although you're focusing in on one particular genotype, one particular, and there are so many other genes, it does sound like there's common, this is a part of a common pathway, and that actually your work, the outcomes could be very relevant.
Yeah, definitely. And we definitely want to understand what those pathways are. There's lots of people researching how the cyclic GMP accumulation ultimately triggers the pathways that cause the death of these cells. So that's, you know, an important part of our project as well, is to understand those cell death pathways in the model. And actually, they're very early, because in our model, we don't see degeneration of the cell. We see this accumulation. So we see things that predate the death of the cells, which is very, very early steps in the pathway. So yeah, I think it could could really help to characterize what happens, you know, early on in these pathways.
That's great, Jackie. Thank you. Jane, thank you for being so patient and waiting for the end. Do you want to just introduce yourself a little more fully and then tell us about how you arrived at your project?
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm Jane Sowden. So I work at Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital at the Institute of Child Health, which is also part of UCL. I'm a professor of genetics and developmental biology, and I also lead a research theme on tissue engineering and regenerative medicine, which is part of our biomedical research centre. And my lab's really interested in how the eye develops normally and how we can try and repair the eye when it's damaged. And my lab has expertise in some of the things we've already heard about, trying to understand which genes cause eye diseases, and also in stem cells, growing the stem cells from patients and then turning them into these mini retina, which we call retinal organoids, which we've heard about from Jackie and from Gabrielle. And so we can both study the diseases and why the retinal cells die, but we can also study the genes that are needed to grow a new retina, and particularly to grow new photoreceptors, that special cell that we need to detect light. And so, that's really my background, and I'm really interested in researching the idea that we can use this kind of knowledge of how the retina normally forms and think about how we could grow a new patch of retina that could
Yes.
be able to replace and repair cells that are lost through disease. And that's
Yeah.
something we've been working on for quite a long time. It's rather an ambitious and futuristic therapy, but that's one of the main things that I'm interested in.
Yeah, so can you just so this the project that we're funding is obviously around this well, creating a patch essentially. For do you want to just outline the project itself in a little bit more detail and what you're going to do?
Yeah, I mean, so as I say, this is quite an ambitious type of therapy, and really to tackle this challenge, we've brought together both the sort of stem cell and retinal developmental biology expertise, but also biochemical engineering to the materials that you'd use to support the cells, tissue engineering expertise, which is trying to create an organized patch of tissue, and then surgical expertise, which would be to deliver such a patch. And so this type of method involves microengineering a little scaffold which has got millimeter dimensions, which is for the new cells to sit in. And to do that, we're using some newly developed light sensitive hydrogels. So these become solid when they're illuminated under a high powered microscope. And
okay.
So we can create very precise and intricate structures that are only a few millimeters in size. And we can design those so they will mimic the dimensions of the retina and accommodate the new cells. And then we can grow new cells from stem cells, the pluripotent stem cells that Jackie was mentioning. So we can create a new population of human photoreceptor cells that we can then add into the scaffold to create a tissue patch. And that patch then is what we're working towards, trying to assess whether that will help survive and organize new photoreceptors that could be implanted into the back of the eye that could potentially restore light sensitivity. And this type of treatment would potentially be useful for people who either haven't got a genetic diagnosis or who have lost their photoreceptors. The degeneration process is advanced. And for those people, there is no natural repair of lost cells. And so, you know, there are a few options, and actually few options really on the horizon. So this type of approach potentially could be useful quite broadly.
So the patch, I mean, the little scaffold, that sounds like that's really important for, I can imagine potentially if you just put these stem cells or these cell-based therapies in, you could end up with cells I don't know, being damaged even by the surgical process, and then not rearranging themselves correctly is so that's the scaffold is attempting to overcome some of those issues, presumably.
Yeah, the scaffold is attempting to pre-organize and mimic the natural organization of the cells. And it's also trying to introduce them in a sort of quite high density. So they would potentially then be positioned perhaps in the retina, in the central retina, where they might be most useful.
Okay. And where do you envisage, in terms of the cells you're actually going to put into the scaffold, where do you envisage those coming from? Are they likely to be induced pluripotent stem cells that have been
So we're actually using, in the first case, an embryonic stem cell line. So right. That's a line that's already established.
Yeah.
So that would be the one we're working with generates the photoreceptors, and those photoreceptors seem to be a very good representation of a real photoreceptor. So if you analyze the genes that have been expressed in them and their appearance and their function, they seem to be real photoreceptors. And for this project, we will use those to generate the photoreceptors. Induced pluripotent stem cells from patients could also be used, but they have the additional problems you have to make them from every different person.
Yes. And presumably from the patient themselves, they're going to have the same genetic fault. Yes. That caused the disease in the first place.
Yes. Ambitiously, you can say you make the person's induced pluripotent stem cell correct the mutation and then new photoreceptors. But we, all these projects interconnect, and the part we're tackling at the moment is using one stem cell line that we know can make photoreceptors and trying to engineer an organized patch that could be transplanted.
It just sounds really, really exciting. We know that so many of our community don't have genetic diagnoses as well, so these sorts of projects that are looking at therapies that could apply to a huge proportion of our community are really important. And just to clarify, Jane, I think you already mentioned that this would be a very small area of the retina, so really this is, as you say, for people potentially a late stage of sight loss, or really about restoring central vision a little bit more, sort of a functional central vision.
Yeah, so ideally the patch would be cone rich, but actually you could tailor the cones or the rods, so we can purify cone photoreceptors or rod photoreceptors, the ones for the kit color high acuity vision or the ones needed for low light conditions, and we can combine those in different proportions within the scaffolded environment, and so yes that could be modified, but the size of a scaffold which we're thinking of as millimeters, if that was put towards the center of the retina, could potentially be useful.
Thank you. That's really interesting. We could talk about all of these projects, I think, for the whole evening, but we have only got until 8 o'clock. And I've seen that I'm just seeing in the corner of my eye that there are an awful lot of questions in the Q&A box. Actually, one of the questions, I'm just going to read them down in order. So we've got a question about, do we have any other current projects focusing on stem cells? Actually, we do have another project going up in Newcastle. And I wonder, Jane, if you could comment on this and whether it would link into your scaffold work in the future, because we're funding Melinda Lacco up in Newcastle, and she's looking at creating stem cells that are invisible to the immune system, so could be made reduce the risk of sort of immune response to the cells that are put in. So do you think there's a potential for a dovetail there, Jane, that those
Yeah, I mean, the idea of making cell types that are not going to be mismatched is a good idea, and one that there is a lot of interest in. And so I think that, or even you have panels, so they would be suitable for some people and not others. And
Yeah, absolutely.
I know Linda.
Yeah. So it's a great idea that actually you could create this bank of cells that could just be taken off the shelf and given to anybody, because otherwise you're talking about hugely time consuming and financially quite challenging to make everybody their own tailored stem cell preparation. So yeah, it's nice.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
We've got a really good question, the great question that always somebody said, great content, so interesting, thank you. A question for any of the panel. Assuming your projects are successful, how long might it be before they translate into treatment? That's a difficult one, isn't it? Anybody want to jump in and make a suggestion? Perhaps those that are a little closer to the actual therapeutic outcome.
I think it's a difficult question because I think all of what we're doing in these projects is preclinical, and it's so on the basis of preclinical proof of concept work, what we all hope is that that then is sufficient to raise significant amounts of money, which would take that forward into first in child or first in human. And it's only with that proof of concept work that there is the possibility of that, but it is that the timelines often are very much dependent on raising the funding. I think this also speaks to the one of the other questions, and you know, the engagement and the partnership and the involvement of Retina UK, your community, other communities focused on research into sight loss is absolutely critical for raising those additional resources to move it forward.
Absolutely. And we're so grateful to all of our supporters who help us, who enable us to do this, because actually researchers like our panelists this evening, you know, charity funding of research in the UK is really important, because we're not bothered about making a profit. We're prepared to fund the risky early stuff where you're just trying to get this proof of concept, really. So thank you so much to all of our supporters, because yes, there is another question about interactions with people living with the conditions. I know that some of you may already have had interaction. I don't know if the students, you want to comment on, obviously, Chloe, you've got some experience, personal experience of contact with people with sight loss. Would you like to meet more of the Retina UK community?
I would, yeah. What I think is really interesting about my project is that we're using patient mutations in mice, and being able to like meet the people behind these mutations, be able to see what impact it has on their day-to-day life and how I could possibly help them would be really good. I think it would really help drive my passion forwards.
Yeah. What about you, Gabrielle? Have you had a chance to meet people that have been living with sight loss, or have you got any personal experience?
I haven't really, but there was an interesting occurrence on our Christmas party where we actually met one of the people who was working in a restaurant where we were attending, and he had a disease that one of my colleagues was working on, so he really wanted to join the clinical trials are ongoing. But I think it will be really interesting to really put a face and experience in this project, because then it becomes a little bit more personal, it becomes more humanized, if you'd like, because you really see how all the hard work that it takes could pay off, since these projects are incredibly challenging and on day-to-day things can really make it's really hard for you, but if you see the patient at the end of the lane, that would benefit, that would definitely push you through, and that would be a very valuable experience to have.
Yeah, well, certainly we love having researchers and students included along to our events. So you're all very welcome anytime. Somebody has asked a very general question about general progress in RP treatment development, which is a huge question in itself, and we haven't really got time to address it now. But to the person that asked that question, you're really welcome to get in touch directly with us at Retina UK, either via the helpline or the office, and we can address that question for you. And there's also lots of information on our website. We've got a re research news section in our website. So if you want to have a general look there to start with, and then follow up after that, if you would like to, you'll be very, very welcome to. That's brought us beautifully to just before 8 o'clock. I just want to say a huge thank you to all our panelists this evening. It's so great when we can hear about projects directly from the scientists who are actually making them happen. And thank you all for joining us in the audience as well. We do hold webinars most months, so keep an eye on our newsletters and the events section of our website for more information. And do just bear in mind we are a registered charity. We receive no government funding and rely on all of you, our wonderful supporters, to raise the funds needed so that we can invest in these fantastic projects. And also, of course, to provide support for the inherited retinal disease community. You can make donations via our website by calling the office. And we've also recently launched the Retina UK Weekly Lottery, with the top prize being a fantastic £25,000. It costs just £1 a week per line, and it's a really fun way to support us. You can sign up on our website or you can call the office on 01280 815 900, and my fundraising colleagues will be more than happy to help you set that up. If you fancy getting active, we also have 5K a day in May challenge coming up. Again, the fundraising team can tell you more about that. We'll be sending out an email over the next couple of days, which has details of where you can re-watch or listen to the audio from tonight's webinar and details of how you can book on to other events. We'll also be seeking your feedback on today's session. Feedback's really valuable for us because it helps us improve our webinars and other services in the future. Again, thank you to all my panelists this evening. Have a lovely rest of the evening and good night.